Hello, friends. Welcome to another episode of Theology in the Raw. I have on the show today Dr. Scott Ray. Scott is an ethics professor at Biola University and Talbot School of Theology. He's been teaching ethics at a graduate or postgraduate level for more than 25 years. He is a humble dude. He is a gracious dude. And he has literally written the textbook on Christian ethics. And it's one of the most widely used textbooks on Christian ethics. And he's just a super sharp dude. And I'm so excited about this because I've been really concerned over the last few years as I hear Christians think through different moral decisions. How do we determine what is right and wrong? Is euthanasia okay? Is same-sex marriage okay? Is warfare okay? Is violence okay? What about abortion and so on and so forth? We all have opinions about these things, but we often don't even really reflect on the ethical methodology we use to arrive at making moral conclusions. This is why I love people like Scott Ray. Scott's going to help us organize our thinking, to expose our consistencies and inconsistencies when we think through some of the tough, most pressing moral decisions that we make either within our life or even on a day-to-day level. So Scott is, we just had a wonderful conversation about all kinds of things related to ethics, and I'm super stoked about this conversation. Hey, if you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com. That's Patreon. You can probably spell it P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Patreon.com/TheologyInTheRaw. Support the show for as little as $5 a month. And also you get lots of perks in return, like monthly Patreon-only podcasts, blogs, community conversations on the Patreon webpage that I devote some time to, and I don't devote much time to other social media outlets to talk to everybody who's out there, but I do try to prioritize my Patreon conversations. Also, March 10th, I will be in San Francisco with a dialogue about sexuality with Justin Lee, and that event is free for all of my Patreon supporters. So if you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/TheologyInTheRaw. And take advantage to the various perks that being a Patreon supporter gives you. And apart from all the perks, you just get the satisfaction of knowing that you're supporting Theology in the Raw. Okay, I'll stop. I'm done. Let's talk to Scott Ray. He's an awesome dude. He's a smart dude. And please enjoy this conversation. Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of Theology in the Raw. I am here with my friend, Dr. Scott Ray. As I said in intro, Scott is an ethics professor at Biola University and Talbot School of Theology. Thanks so much for being on the show, Scott.
Sure, Preston, happy to be with you and always happy to talk about ethics.
Well, how long have you been doing ethics? I mean, or teaching ethics? Has it been like 20 years or so?
Yeah, it's more like 20, 25 to 30, actually.
Wow.
And it was, I think what I found is that there's an occupational hazard in this because a lot of the things that I've been working on have followed me home over the years. God's got kind of an interesting sense of humor on this because particularly my area, my main area in bioethics, my wife and I wrestled with infertility about the same time I started studying this seriously.
Wow.
With assisted suicide being a public debate, we started walking parents through terminal illnesses.
Oh, wow.
And then when the Human Genome Project came online a few years ago, my wife had a major history of breast cancer in her family. And one of the early genetic tests to come out of that was the test for the genetic glitch that gave women an 85 to 90% likelihood of getting breast cancer. So
wow.
I think I'm going to take up the prosperity gospel next and see if that'll follow me home.
Man, that's uncanny. That's crazy, man.
A lot of these things that I have been writing about and speaking about have also been, they've been dinner table conversations and bedside discussions with my dad and when he was terminally ill and lots of stuff that, is really, if it fits the title of your program, it's very much Theology in the Raw.
So you're not doing ethics from just a detached ivory tower. You are
I mean, in the most literal way, I mean, living this stuff out. That's
sometimes I wish I were detached in the ivory tower, because it's gut-wrenching emotional decisions. Wow. And, you know, anytime somebody says, well, the stuff you've written has been really helpful to me, that's a mixed blessing, because I said, I'm glad it's been helpful, but I'm really sorry that you're in a situation where it can actually be helpful to you.
Yeah. I do recall now the bioethics in particular is your primary area. Was that like a topic of your dissertation or just something
you pursued? My dissertation was on the ethics of surrogate motherhood. And this was 25, 30 years ago when surrogacy was just getting started, and, you know, it was the stuff of TV miniseries and all this crazy stuff was going on.
Wow.
And the courts were just deciding what to do with all this. So it's really, you know, it's really prime time to get into that discussion. It's not, I wouldn't say it's receded, but it's not quite the hot ethical topic that it was when it first, you know, came out.
What do you think, what are the number one, two, or three hot ethical topics that you see just keep coming up?
Well, I think probably number one would be issues related to sexuality, marriage, sexuality, transgender type things. Mm-hmm. Second, I would say probably not far behind are things related to immigration, refugees, asylum seekers, things like that. Third, I would say, would be just the way we think about morality in general, I think, has changed significantly in the last 20 years or so.
How so? Can you unpack that a bit? I would love to hear.
Well, for one, I think there's a new absolutism that has arisen, I think, probably in the last, maybe in, we've kind of come to see this maybe in the last 10 years or so. Where, especially on college campuses, I don't think it's quite accurate to say that relativism is the cultural, you know, ethical system of the day. I think there's a new sense of absolutism, really rigid absolutism, that's taken hold on lots of state university campuses and culture in general. Because try saying a politically incorrect thing.
Yeah.
On most state university college campuses, and you will generally not be met with tolerance and understanding and sensitivity. It is it's at times almost a brutal, rigid absolutism that has taken hold. If you cross the line on certain very politically incorrect issues.
Yeah.
So that I think is something new that we haven't seen all that much of until the last 10 years or so.
Well, are you familiar with what happened at Evergreen University with Brett Weinstein?
That's a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
And that's being multiplied on state universities all over the country, which is why people like Jonathan Haidt and Jordan Peterson are so popular.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're, you know, at least I think they're being honest enough to say that things like free speech and free inquiry are being stifled in the name of a new orthodoxy that I think is actually much more rigid and unbending than any kind of religious morality we've seen in the last 100 years.
Oh, I totally agree. So Jonathan Haidt's probably my favorite author right now. Did you read his recent book, The Coddling of the American Mind?
Oh, he's terrific.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, it's scary, but it's really good.
came to Biola.
No
and
way.
Spoke on that subject.
Oh, wow.
Before the book came out. He just hit a home run.
Oh, he's so good. So I want to talk about the book in a second, but you got me so intrigued right now, because this is, I would say in the last year has been something I don't talk about a lot on the podcast, but it's been something I've been paying really close attention to and really kind of disturbed by it. Have you seen, I mean, you're talking primarily about state universities, public, you know, colleges and whatever. Have you seen it on your own campus though? A similar kind of vibe of the sort of, you know, intolerance of, or the, what is it? The, yeah, the intolerance of tolerance, so to speak, or?
I think maybe just a bit. I understand kind of where it comes from, mm-hmm. because people, I think, you know, generally, and this goes back to the way we think about morality and in general, because if we believe that morality is nothing more than matters of opinion, mm-hmm. then there's no way to explain why we are so passionate about moral matters. The reality is, Preston, we treat moral discussions completely differently than we do most anything else. Mm. We treat moral matters as though they are objectively true, and they are not strictly matters of opinion. I mean, I got a matter of opinion about my favorite flavor of ice cream, but I rarely talk passionately about that. Mm-hmm. You know, I have my subjective opinion on who I think is going to win the Super Bowl, but I rarely talk very passionately about that. Now, maybe some do so about sports. That may have other things that we probably ought to talk about. But we generally treat morality matters as though they are matters of truth and knowledge. Ask someone if they think that racial discrimination is morally wrong. And I think they would say, most people I think would say, that if you disagree with me about racial discrimination being morally wrong, it's not just that you have a different perspective on it or view it through a different set of lenses. You would say that you're just flat out wrong about mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And so I think we tend to treat these moral matters differently, which suggests to me that there's something more intrinsic and fundamental about morality that's sort of hardwired into the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we generally don't shame somebody for thinking that that Coke tastes better than Pepsi, or that chocolate's a better flavor of ice cream than vanilla, or that, you know, the Greek islands is a more beautiful vacation spot than Hawaii. But if somebody thinks that, you know, racial discrimination is morally acceptable, we correctly, I think, bring something akin to what in the past we would call shame or guilt or remorse, you know, mm-hmm. or things like that. We don't do that for things that we just have different subjective opinions about. Hmm.
That's interesting. You know, well, I can't stop thinking about how this relates to the whole college campus thing. What do you think has happened? Where did this come from that college campuses have become so intolerant of any sort of view or idea that challenges a particular, and I would say far left kind of narrative? I mean, it's not, you know, you mentioned like, you know, try saying something politically incorrect on campus and see how that goes. And that's absolutely true. And I would even push it farther and say, try saying something just remotely conservative or something that would challenge the sort of, you know, really specific ideology that would be yeah. more or less, you know, far, not liberal, liberals, you know, more illiberal or even on, you know, on the far left way of thinking.
I've often wanted to ask on state university campuses, if you're so committed to diversity, you know, mm-hmm. why are you committed to the diversity of everything except diversity of thought?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So I say, if you're really committed to diversity of thought on state university campuses, then show me the female faculty who are pro-life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guarantee you won't find one.
Yeah.
You know, show me the African American faculty member who thinks that you know, affirmative action back in the, you know, 80s and 90s was a bad idea.
Yeah.
You'll likely get crucified for that.
Yeah.
I tell my seminary students, when we have our discussions about sexuality, if we had this discussion on any state university campus, we'd be thrown off. And we'd be villainized.
Right.
So I think where this came from in my judgment is I think what started out as something with good intentions, but has taken on a worldview that is, I think, decidedly hostile to a Christian worldview. I think it started out with good intentions to give a voice to groups and individuals who had been marginalized in the past. Mm-hmm. But where it's taken on its absolutism is it's adopted what I would suggest is more what I would call a neo-Marxist view of the world that sees the world almost exclusively through the lenses of oppressor and oppressed.
Right. Like either you're one or the other. Either you have power. That's right. And if you have power, that means you stepped on somebody else to get that power. Or, and if you have power, then you are an oppressor. If you're not an oppressor, you are oppressed, right? You divide the world in terms of good and evil, powerful, non-powerful, which ends up being white straight males are the oppressor, the perpetrator, the ones with the power, and everybody else is the victim, which is a really not only skewed view of reality, which is not real, but it's incredibly dehumanizing and really dangerous, right? I mean, we've seen where this Marxist ideology can and has led to, and it leads to the death of millions of people, right?
Yeah, that's why I'm not enthused about neo-Marxism, because I've seen, you know, you saw in the 20th century exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I think what starts out as good intentions, I think, mm-hmm. and I think the social justice movement, I think, is in danger of adopting a neo-Marxist framework, perhaps inadvertently. And that's the worldview that I think is without a doubt hostile to a distinctly Christian view of the world.
Could you unpack what you mean by social justice? Because when I hear that, I have kind of two different, I guess, debates in my mind. One would be more of a political, kind of the SJW, social justice warrior, which is a neo-Marxist kind of ideology. But then also on the far other end of the spectrum, you have debates within conservative evangelicalism on whether social justice is part of the mission of the church, part of the gospel, or whatever. And those are kind of two very different ideas of what social justice is.
You're right. They're completely different. I think we need to be clear first, and you know, with you being a New Testament guy, you know, I'm going to start with the Old Testament, so hang in there with me. But it's reinforced in the New Testament. I do think that the Bible is incredibly clear about the responsibility of the people of God to those who are poor, needy, marginalized, mm-hmm. And who are outside the cultural sort of mainstream. That's not quite the term I'm looking for, but are they on the margins of society? Homeless, the poor, those that have been discriminated against. Lots of minority groups fit into this category. And the Bible is very clear that God has a special place in his heart for those who have been, you know, relegated to the margins. The prophets, I think, are very eloquent on this. And I actually think this is a big part of what Jesus meant when he said, you know, whatever you do to the least of these, my brothers, you do for me. Mm-hmm. The New Testament, I think, is just crystal clear about this. And I think, you know, if you actually cut out all those passages in the scripture that related to the poor and the marginalized, you'd have an incomplete scripture. Mm-hmm. I don't see any place for this what I would call old school pietism that says all you do is preach the gospel. You know, the culture's going to hell in a handbasket, and so any attempt to do any kind of social mission that's not preaching the gospel is sort of equivalent to rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. And I think the response to that is that, you know, throughout the scripture, where the kingdom is described, it has both an individual and a social component to it. The kingdom has a structural component to it that, you know, every when the kingdom comes in its fullness, every knee will bow at the name of Christ, but we will also have a society that functions free from sin and corruption. And I admit, I still have difficulty kind of getting my arms around exactly what that looks like. But I think our attempts to minister and serve among the poorest of the poor is I would say a kingdom foretaste of what we'll see when the kingdom comes in its fullness. Okay? So
that's good.
So the sort of what I would call almost an old school pietistic view that says all we do is preach the gospel and culture sort of takes care of itself. I don't think the Bible supports that. And so I think the Bible supports what I would call a high role for justice. I don't really care if you call it social justice or not. The term I think has some baggage attached to it. That in lots of places has this neo-Marxist framework in it that I find problematic. But whether we call it social justice or not, that's not a hill I'm willing to die on. Mm-hmm. I think what we mean by that is ensuring that we reach the those that have been relegated to the margins and reflect the heart of God for them. Hmm. Now, whether it's part of the gospel or not, I think is a, I would call that's a distinction without a meaningful difference. Hmm. Because, whether it's part of the gospel message or not, it seems really clear that developing a heart for the poor and the marginalized is a pretty important element of faithfully following Christ. So whether you want to say it's part of the gospel, I'm inclined to say it's probably not. I'm inclined to say the gospel is what Paul delivered the message of the death and resurrection of Jesus and our response to that he delivered in 1 Corinthians 15. But I don't think that gets anybody off the hook because I would say a constituent part of faithfully following Jesus is developing this tender heart and living out that heart for the poor and the marginalized.
Mm, that's good. That's good. I think everything you articulated there, I think would be really helpful, especially for conservative evangelical Christianity that seems really nervous about making quote social justice a bigger part of the mission of the church. I think their nervousness is that they are understanding social justice through the lens of this kind of neo-Marxist political thing going on rather than seeing, and maybe it's a terminological thing. Maybe we need to come up with a different term. Maybe when people hear social justice, it just triggers them to think of, stuff going on in culture. But
I do know folks who are, who are basically allergic to that term.
Yeah.
Which I think is unfortunate.
Yeah, because I've said some things on Twitter and other outlets where I being kind of ignorant of how other people are understanding social justice, where I would have, like you, a very high view of social justice, but I'm not really talking about the political conversation. I'm just talking about the biblical. I'm using the term to capture what is indisputably a main thread of the story of Scripture.
Yeah. And I think we have to look at this historically a bit too. And the fears of the idea of social justice, I think, come from our experience with the social gospel 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Where, the social mission of the church became everything.
Right.
And I think the reason for that is because at the same time that the social gospel was really making headway, the sort of the fundamentals of Christian faith were being undercut.
Mm-hmm.
By higher critical methods and higher critical scholarship. And so the person of Jesus was essentially being sort of spiritually emasculated.
Yeah.
And the Bible was being, trust in the Bible was at an all-time low at that point. So the social gospel was all that people had. And so, of course, the gospel message got obscured and marginalized itself in the process.
Right. Yeah, that's good. Hey, Scott, I want to circle back around. Let's go back to your book. So the book, we've referred to your book a few times. You haven't actually said the name. It's called Moral Choices. Oh, I have it here on my desk, an Introduction to Ethics, and it's in the fourth edition. Now, as I said, off the air, before we started, this first came out, was it 94, 96, something like that?
94.
And it was about a fourth of the length, I think, of what it is now. It's now the fourth edition, and it is a massive, well, textbook almost sounds demeaning because people think of textbooks being boring and dry and overpriced. I mean, it is a textbook on ethics, but it is so relevant and engaging and clear and easy to read. When you sent me the copy, I'm like, man, this is a serious work. And I'm so thankful for how many years of, you know, thinking and study have gone into it.
I react a bit to people calling it a textbook because I'd like it to be used for something more than a doorstop.
Totally. Yeah, no, totally. And what I love about it is you spend, I mean, several chapters talking about, you know, kind of a history of ethics and different ethical frameworks. But then you go in, a bulk of the book is talking about immigration and warfare and sexuality and gender and bioethics and all these things. So you actually go, the bulk of the book, right, is, I mean, you're tackling head on the hot button issues of the day and using the framework that you discussed to think through it. I want to start by, can you give us just a brief overview of some of the main Christian ethical systems? I'm talking about, say, deontological ethics or virtue ethics or natural law, or maybe we could even include something like, situation ethics or utilitarian ethics, which aren't particularly Christian per se, but are really assumed, kind of the assumed ethical perspective of a lot of Christians. So, give us a quick lay of the land. What are the different options for Christians to think ethically?
Well, yeah, I think there's probably three different ways of thinking about morality that Christian ethics would be a blend of all three of these. One is, primarily a blend of principles and virtues.
Okay.
So the technical term for those would be deontological systems, which for a deontological system, things are intrinsically right or wrong. They don't depend on the outcome or the circumstances. And the reason ultimately is because it goes, for a deontological system, it goes back to the principle of the thing. Mm-hmm. Everything's a matter of principle. Now, by complement, a virtue ethic is it designed to, remedy some of the shortcomings or how deontological ethics, I guess, was incomplete. Mm-hmm. Because the way principle-based ethics came to be understood was as only being applicable to somebody's actions.
Hmm.
All of these are called action-based ethical systems. Well, the virtue person comes along and says, well, there's a lot more to the moral life than that. Because we have, what really matters is people's character and what they do when nobody's looking and when they're not acting. So there's more to moral assessment than just the action. Now, from a Christian worldview, both of those are important because ultimately the ultimate source for morality is God's character. And the principle, the moral principles and values that come out of Scripture are all based on a prior commitment to God's character. The reason we have the principles and values that we do is because God's the kind of God that He is. Hmm. Now, we may say, well, you know, love makes the world go round, and that's true, but the reason we're called to love our neighbor is because God is fundamentally that kind of God.
Hmm.
Reason we're mandated to be forgiving is not because forgiveness fundamentally heals fractured relationships, though that's true. Fundamentally, it's because God is at His core, in His character, a forgiving God. So we have the virtues or God's character is the ultimate source for morality, from which our principles and moral values, you know, fall out of those. Now, the natural law tradition is more how those things get communicated and how those are revealed to the average person. Because the natural law tradition essentially says that that God reveals moral values not only in his word, but also in his world. And that God has embedded, or I like the term, that's sort of a play on words that I think the natural law folks use, that God has engraved his moral values and principles into his world, analogous to how he engraved the Ten Commandments on stone. And they, you know, if you look, take Proverbs, many of the Proverbs, for example, are I think, are great examples of this. And what I think so remarkable about those is that most of the biblical Proverbs are not original.
Yeah.
When they were written down. Most of the biblical Proverbs have precedent in the ancient Near Eastern world that goes back as much as 1,000 years prior to when Solomon and others actually wrote those down, which suggests that God was already in the business of revealing his wisdom throughout his creation, and giving through common grace and general revelation, giving human beings the tools to unearth what God has embedded in the created order. Now, I think, obviously, Scripture, I think, is primary because it's clearer. And Scripture also gives us the saving knowledge of God, which natural law does not. Natural law is sufficient to condemn, but not to save.
Right.
So I would see those. That's how I'd see those traditions, the deontological, the virtue, and the natural law tradition coming together. I think there's a place for thinking about the consequences or utilitarian ways of thinking, even though it was not designed, it was actually designed as a departure from Christian ethics, not as a complement. But the biblical Proverbs, for example, the Proverbs, say the sentence Proverbs that start in about chapter 10 and go through, you know, chapter 24, 25, are all basically illustrations of the fact that actions have consequences.
Yeah.
And but so
that, real quick. So, but with utilitarian, I mean, if I understand it correctly, it's one thing to say that this good behavior will lead to good consequences, but it's another thing to say this behavior is good because of the consequences that it leads to. I'm just kind of thinking out loud. Is that?
Well, that's a good distinction. That the consequences don't make things right.
Right.
Like they do for a utilitarian. And you know, and if you think about it, in a world where God has embedded his moral wisdom into his created order, the fact that doing the right thing would have good consequences, for the most part, is the way it ought to be.
Right.
Nobody should be surprised by that. I would say the consideration of utility or consequences is more the caboose on the train. But for the utilitarian, it's the engine that drives the whole thing.
Right.
In a Christian worldview, I don't think we can say that it's the engine that drives the whole thing, but we would expect that it be part of the trend.
So would you say that most Christian ethicists would agree with you on just the last couple of minutes of what you said about utilitarian ethics? And I've got a follow-up question. There's a reason why I'm asking that.
So the ones that I'm familiar with, I think would. I don't know of anybody off the top of my head who's, you know, a serious scholar in Christian ethics who would say that utilitarianism as a standalone ethical theory is sufficient and fully reflects biblical teaching.
So, okay, so I'm going to follow that up with this, with a few questions related to sexuality. I'm luring you in, and I know you and I are on the same page on so many levels on this conversation, but one argument that I feel the
hook going in my cheek.
Well, one argument that I've been wrestling with, it's a powerful argument because I think it hits people, it touches their hearts, but I think ethically and logically, it's just pretty bankrupt. But yet it's so incredibly popular. It might be the most popular argument for affirming same-sex relationships or same-sex marriage in the church. And it's what I call the harm argument. And you're probably familiar with it. It goes something like this, that, you know, because the traditional or historically Christian sexual ethic is harmful toward gay people, towards LGBTQ people, therefore it can't be good. Now, I have no doubt. In fact, part of my life commitment is reducing and addressing and confronting the harm that Christians have done and do and are doing toward LGBT people. So no doubt in my mind that some Christians, and in the past, probably many Christians, have harmed gay people. I have no doubt also that those same Christians that may have harmed gay people also hold to a traditional sexual ethic. Okay, so those two points I totally agree with. But does that mean, I guess the crux of the argument is it the traditional Christian view that marriage is between a man and a woman? Is it that particular view that's causing the harm? It's one thing to show correlation. It's quite another to try to prove causation. But even if all of that was true, I mean, it's, first of all, it's pretty subjective. I think it's hard to, how would you actually prove that it's actually the traditional view of marriage that is forcing or causing Christians to harm gay people? But even if we agree with all of that, that still does feel like a utilitarian ethic. You're determining the good of something based on the results of the opposite view. So would you, based on everything I said, if I'm representing the argument correctly, wouldn't that be a utilitarian, an argument that is based on a utilitarian way of thinking, which isn't a particularly Christian way of doing ethics?
I think it's probably fair to say that that argument smuggles in a utilitarian view of morality, because there are other things to be considered. For one, I mean, I think you do have to, if you're gonna make a utilitarian argument, correlation's not good enough.
Right.
You have to show causation for that. And I think you could probably actually turn the utilitarian argument on its head and say, you know, lots of people have actually been harmed by accepting this affirming view of sexuality. I think the harm that has come in general to people as a result of the overall sexual revolution from the 60s is impossible to ignore.
Right. Yeah.
So, and that goes a lot wider than the same sex discussion. You know, that has to do with, you know, the divorce culture, mm-hmm. You know, the contraception revolution, you know, and the same sex discussion. So, but I think the question I think, Preston, you're getting at is why should we view, why should the argument from the outcome automatically be the trump card?
Right.
And I think you're right, I think, to distinguish between the way the argument has been made, the style of it, and the argument itself. And I think that, you know, and I think that, you know, we've got to own, you know, our part in this, in the past. You know, the church behaved abominably in the past, which I think explains a lot of the ferocity of the LGBT movement in the aftermath of the Obergefell decision.
Yeah.
It's payback. Yeah. And understandably so.
Right.
But I think, you know, we need to be careful, I think, that we don't, you know, smuggle in a system that we're asking to do all of the work and give that trump card status.
Yeah.
See, I think the problem with utilitarian modes of reasoning, you know, as this all-comprehensive system of morality, is who's to say what constitutes a harm?
Right.
I mean, You're begging the question on that, and I would say that for a utilitarian system to actually work, there's a prior commitment to certain principles that tell you that certain things are harmful.
Yeah.
I mean, who's to tell the Muslim family who ritually circumcises their daughter that she's been harmed?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, on what basis are these things harms and benefits? And you usually can't say that without some sort of prior commitment to principles or virtues.
Well, it seems to kind of collapse, you know, things like pain or suffering or hardship and harm all under a large umbrella of quote unquote harm. And yeah, and then you can kind of, but I wonder if also what's feeding that is the modern just passion to pursue pleasure and comfort, and you know, where especially in American or Western society, especially in a wealthy elite society, any form of kind of suffering or hardship is viewed as not just bad, but in kind of intrinsically evil almost.
No, it's viewed as immoral.
Immoral, and yeah.
That's the old school utilitarianism of Jeremy Bentham, who calculated utility in terms specifically of pain and pleasure.
Really?
And that's what's come back today. Although he viewed it a little bit differently. He viewed it through the lenses of basically a social consensus at that time about what constituted legitimate pains and pleasures.
Okay.
Which we've lost all of that today. Today, what it's become translated as, I would say, is more of an old school hedonism. The satisfaction of my desires makes something morally right and therefore worth pursuing. But I suspect it's probably a good thing our wives aren't listening to this at the moment. But if I did everything according to my desires, I don't know about you, but I would certainly be polygamous. And it seems to me most of Christian ethics is designed to put limits and boundaries on our desires, not to give full fruition to them.
That also plays into another popular argument, the argument from orientation, that if somebody has a quote unquote sexual orientation a particular way, that therefore justifies the behavior that might spring from that orientation. Now, I think sometimes, well, first of all, I think that we don't understand what we even mean when we say sexual orientation. I think that whole concept is way more complicated than people make it out to be. But that's, I mean, a sexual orientation is just a modern way of talking about a sexual desire. Now we can say, is it innate? Is it biological? Is it changeable? Whatever. But really, at the end of the day, it's justifying a behavior based on the desire from which that behavior springs. But that's even more distant from a Christian way of thinking than even a utilitarian.
It's completely foreign.
Yeah.
To a Christian. I mean, I look at the teaching of Jesus where it talks about, you know, deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me. And it seems to me that on the list of priorities that are important to Jesus, the satisfaction of my desires is pretty far down the list.
Right. Yeah.
You know, not that all my desires are problematic, but to assume that just because you have a desire, I mean, this is sort of the, you know, we're back to, you know, the old moral philosophy of David Hume again. And Hume had been, you know, completely discredited around the turn of the 20th century. Yet he's finding quite a resurrection at the popular level. I don't think David Hume ever envisioned himself being this popular.
I'm just old school enough. I just turned 43 a couple of days ago. So I have I kind of have one foot in the millennial generation, and I've been teaching college like you have for years. And so I understand the way people think who are, you know, between 40 and 20, but I also very much understand, you know, the boomers ahead of me, you know? How do you explain I mean, it's one thing to say that society adopts a utilitarian or situation ethics or is pursuing pleasure at all costs, and that's kind of a good in and of itself. But that it seems like the church has largely adopted this way of ethically moral reasoning, and then maybe not explicitly, but it's just kind of absorbed it. It just seems so clear when you read scripture, just like what you said, that satisfying our desires is not the rhythm of New Testament ethical thinking, and yet it seems to be kind of the default for so many people, even inside the church. Is that, I mean, that might be an overstatement, but are you, when you talk in class and as you talk to young people and stuff, I mean, does the light switch on pretty clearly, or do you still get pushback for even some of the things you've been saying the last few
weeks? Well, I think what happens with my seminary students, a lot of whom are youth pastors and college pastors, is I think they recognize that I'm right biblically, mm-hmm. but they don't have any idea how to put this into practice and still attract high school and college students to their ministry.
Wow. Okay.
And so what we've tried to suggest is that, you know, what Barna and others tell us is that, you know, the keep me entertained thing among high school and college students is really old school. And what high school students want more than anything else is for somebody to answer their questions. And to recognize that they're asking hard questions that we need to be answering. And I think there are lots of churches that are exceptions to this.
Sure.
But I think in general, I think we are promoting a relatively superficial faith that, I think is done really well at getting people out and serving and, you know, putting shoe leather on a big part of their faith, but has not been so good at really answering tough questions. One of the things, Preston, you'll be encouraged with this, I think, that I'm very encouraged about is our program in philosophy and in apologetics here at Biola has started to put more and more of an emphasis on women in apologetics.
Yeah.
Because we recognize that it's moms who spend moms spend a lot of these formative years with their kids. And it's moms that need the tools for apologetics to answer a lot of these tough questions that their kids are asking. And so we're seeing a new generation of women, you know, really take on the commitment to doing really good, serious theology and apologetics in service of their kids. And I think that I'd like to see our churches do a little more of that.
I couldn't agree more. I have four kids, 15, 13, 11, and 9. And I mean, they ask such deep questions and people say, oh, well, that's because they grew up in your household and whatever. Like, I rarely sit around and like read theology books to my kids or whatever. Like, our environment is actually not naturally very intellectual. So I don't think it's just because they grew up in my household and I'm an intellect. They're teenagers that have really hard questions about a lot of different things. And they don't want to know just what to believe. They want to know why I'm supposed to believe this. And I could not agree more. I think that, I think our youth groups and junior high groups and high school groups and so on and college groups, whatever, should be just bombarded with intellectually rigorous and clear and compelling conversations. And I just, I know it's a stereotype, but it is for a reason that's not the typical way in which youth groups are run. People like Kara Powell and even like, you know, Barna and others that I'm seeing a change in that, though. There is kind of have you seen this? I mean, it seems like there is a real intentional and really helpful rethinking of, you know, youth ministry and just youth in general in the church these days. It seems like we're kind of at a crossroads. Have you recognized that? Or
I've seen, some of my students tell me that they're intentionally going smaller and deeper.
Yeah. Man, that's great.
I think is terrific.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, the thing that I think was off-putting to my own kids, because they, you know, they grew up in a high school group. And what they saw is, and maybe this is unique to this particular place, but what they saw is that the people who were most serious about their faith were the ones who were rigid and legalistic. Mm-hmm. And the other, the other half were the ones who were, you know, in church on Sunday, but out, you know, sort of big time in the party scene mm-hmm. the rest of the week. And so they viewed it as either rigidly legalistic or hypocritical. And they just didn't see much that was in the middle where people were really taking their faith seriously, but were doing it in a non-judgmental way. Mm-hmm. And I realize that people, you know, high school students are in a relatively early stage of moral development where sometimes those rigid boundaries are just part of the program. But that it was kind of unfortunate that that was their experience. We tried our best to, you know, answer those questions when they raised them. You know, your house is a lot like mine. You know, we spend a lot of time watching and playing sports together, not reading theology. But a lot of those questions come out, you know, when we're having dinner after the hoop game.
Right.
You know, so part of it, I think, is just for parents. It's just like being friends with your non-believing neighbors. You know, you're just around, you're there, you're in their lives. And you respond when these things come up. It's in the air.
Yeah.
So it's going to come up.
Switching gears just slightly. I remember seeing from a distance some conversations about sexuality that keep kind of coming up on BYLA's campus. And I know Zeus has gone through some stuff and several other Christian schools. Going back to the sexuality conversation, how are things at BYLA? Are you free to talk about it, or are there tensions and conflict and stuff, or is it not too bad?
You know, I think we're in a little different place, I think, than some other places, because we have a really clear theological distinctive on marriage and sexuality. That's part of what every faculty member signs on to. And that's part of the filter that we use in screening and recruiting faculty. Our president has said all along, has said, if you're waiting for our view of marriage and sexuality to change, you know, it's not going to. Our board of trustees has been very clear that our view of marriage and sexuality is not going to change on their watch, sort of regardless of, you know, of what the, you know, what the external forces, you know, bring to us. We've been, you know, we're, you know, like a lot of Christian colleges in California, we're in the sights of the legislature, lots of folks in the legislature think we ought to be out of business,
right?
Because
right.
of our views on marriage. We're asking simply to be left alone to live out our deepest convictions as we see fit. And so far, we're still able to do that. We have students on campus who are wrestling with their sexual orientation or their sexual attraction. We have a place where we're trying to walk a really fine line, which we want to be supportive to those students who are wrestling with their sexual attraction, but who want to do it in the context of taking their faith seriously.
Right.
You know, so we want to provide that kind of support while at the same time not affirming, you know, the LGBT agenda.
Right.
Maintaining, you know, fidelity to our convictions about marriage and sexuality while at the same time being pastoral toward folks who are wrestling with their sexual attraction, not always an easy thing to do.
No, not at all. But the stuff I've read on your website is fantastic. I mean, and you have lots of people there who are, you know, like yourself and Sean and several others that have thought through this, you know, very in-depthly and very pastorally. So, the wording and documents and stuff you guys have are fantastic. Was there like kind of an underground LGBT group on campus a while back that was trying to, or is that just kind of over? I mean, I think every campus probably has some underground LGBT group these days, but was that not a big deal?
Well, I don't think that was a major thing.
Okay.
you know, I wouldn't surprise me if we had students who are waiting for our theological distinctive on marriage and sexuality to change and hoping it would change. But I think for a lot of students, I think they're taking their faith seriously. They want to grow in their faith. You know, I'm not sure some of this is all that big an issue to them.
Yeah.
Now for others it is, because it's more personal.
Sure. Yeah.
But you know, I'm actually a lot more interested in talking about things like the biblical authority and the resurrection of Jesus and our service to the poor and things like that. The sexuality is not going to go away because it's culturally in the air.
Right.
Do we have students who kind of wish our views would change? I'm sure we do.
Yeah.
But I think if from the very top of the institution, you know, they're on marriage and sexuality, they're not going to change.
Yeah. We're getting close to an hour here, but one more quick question regarding bioethics. So is euthanasia is becoming a hot topic recently. Is that, am I reading the Times correctly? Is that coming up more and more now?
No, I wouldn't say more and more. There have been a couple of pretty visible folks in the last 2 or 3 years that have opted for assisted suicide in the states where it's been legal.
Okay.
It's probably more of an issue in Europe.
Okay.
What's disturbing to me about that trend in particularly in Europe and Australia, we see it Australia as well, is the connection that's made between the demographic landslide that's taking place as us baby boomers turn 65 and older,
yeah,
and how that's going to tax our medical system, and connecting that to legalizing assisted suicide.
For economic reasons?
Reasons, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because as a colleague of mine put it a while back, there's nothing cheaper than dead.
oh my gosh.
And, you know, people in Europe have actually said, you know, if you have serious illness or if you have dementia, you know, you are wasting the resources of the national health system.
Wow.
So that's, I think, what I'd encourage your listeners to have their antenna up for is the way it's being increasingly connected with, the fact that our healthcare system, if we try to give everybody everything they want and need at the end of their lives, we'll go bankrupt.
Hmm. Wow. Wow, that's fascinating.
Now, to be clear, too, that's not to say that it's immoral to say for a person, say on life support, to say stop to medicine. Mm-hmm. I think under the right conditions, that's theologically okay because death is a conquered enemy, and therefore because it's a conquered enemy, it need not always be resisted. That under the right circumstances, we can stop treatments that are futile or more burdensome than beneficial and essentially turn that person back to the Lord for him to take him or her in whatever time frame the Lord sees fit.
So would you say that assisted suicide is always morally wrong, or are there any situation where you would say it might be, I don't know, the lesser two evils or the higher moral good?
I think assisted suicide, I would say that's always morally wrong.
Okay.
Because there's almost always another option to do what people really want at the end of life, which is to control their pain and give them some sort of control over the end of life. Hmm. And this is where you'll find the hospice movement almost universally opposes assisted suicide. Because they recognize that they have a good answer. Mm-hmm. My dad was in hospice care. Those hospice workers were the closest thing to guardian angels I've seen this side of eternity.
Wow.
And what they did for my dad was fantastic. And he never thought about assisted suicide, not because he's a believer, but because he was so well cared for in hospice. And hospice is still dramatically underutilized
really
in our culture today.
Well, Scott, we are rounding the corner at an hour, so I'm going to let you go. Again, the book is Moral Choices and Introduction to Ethics. Make sure if you're sniffing around on Amazon right now, make sure you get the fourth edition. It is you might find the other ones cheaper, but the fourth edition is a massive, awesome resource that is again, I can't emphasize enough. I still feel bad that I called it a textbook. I mean, if I was going to teach a class on ethics, I would probably use it as a textbook, but I was not shocked because I'm familiar with your writings, but you will be shocked if you're not familiar with Scott's writings, at how just clear and engaging it is. So where can people find you if they're interested in your other works? I mean, obviously they can, you know, Google you or whatever, but do you have a website or a faculty page at the university?
Look me up. I do have a website, but it's at talbot.edu.
Okay, cool.
Talbot.edu is the place, and then you'll search under faculty.
Okay.
That's the best place.
Scott, hey, thanks so much. Yeah, thanks for being on.
Enjoyed it. I love it.
All right, we'll have to have you on again sometime soon.
You bet. Anytime.
All right, take care, Scott.